this choice is that Betsy Ross never did anything. Frisch notes that she played no role whatsoever in the actual creation of any actual first flag. Ross came to prominence around 1876 when some of her descendants, seeking to create a tourist attraction in Philadelphia, largely invented the myth of the first flag. With justice, high school textbooks universally ignore Betsy Ross. Not one of my 12 books lists her in its index. So how and why does her story get transmitted? Frisch offers a hilarious explanation. If George Washington is the father of our country, then Betsy Ross is our Blessed Virgin Mary. Frisch describes the pageants reenacted, or did we only imagine them, in our elementary school years. Washington, the god, calls on the humble seamstress Betsy Ross in her tiny home and asks her if she will make the nation's flag to his design. And Betsy promptly brings forth from her lap the nation itself and the promise of freedom and natural rights for all mankind. I think Frisch is on to something, but maybe he is merely on something. Whether or not one buys his explanation, Betsy Ross's ranking among students surely proves the power of the social archetype. In the case of Woodrow Wilson, textbooks actually participate in creating social archetype. Wilson is portrayed as good, idealist, for self-determination, not colonial intervention, foiled by an isolationist Senate, and ahead of his time. We name institutions after him, from the Woodrow Wilson Center at the Smithsonian Institution to Woodrow Wilson Junior High School in Decatur, Illinois, where I misspent my adolescence. If a fifth face were to be chiseled into Mount Rushmore, many Americans would propose that it should be Wilson's. Against such archetypal goodness, even the unusually forthright treatment of Wilson's racism in Land of Promise cannot but fail to stick in students' minds. Curators of history museums know that their visitors bring archetypes in with them. Some curators consciously design exhibits to confront these archetypes when they are inaccurate. Textbook authors, teachers, and movie makers would better fulfill their educational mission if they also taught against inaccurate archetypes. Surely Woodrow Wilson doesn't need their flattering omissions, after all. His progressive legislative accomplishments in just his first 2 years, including tariff reform, an income tax, the Federal Reserve Act, and the Working Men's Compensation Act, are almost unparalleled. Wilson's speeches on behalf of self-determination stirred the world, even if his actions didn't live up to his words. Why do textbooks promote warrantless stereotypes? The author's omissions and errors can hardly be accidental. The producers of the film strips, movies, and other educational materials on Helen Keller surely know she was a socialist. No one can read Keller's writings without becoming aware of her political and social philosophy. At least one textbook author, Thomas Bailey, senior author of The American Pageant, clearly knew of the 1918 U.S. invasion of Russia, for he wrote in a different venue in 1973, American troops shot it out with Russian armed forces on Russian soil in two theaters from 1918 to 1920. Probably several other authors knew of it, too. Wilson's racism is also well known to professional historians. Why don't they let the public in on these matters? Heroification itself supplies a first answer. Socialism is repugnant to most Americans. So are racism and colonialism. Michael Kamen suggests that authors selectively omit blemishes in order to make certain historical figures sympathetic to as many people as possible. The textbook critic Norma Gobler has testified that textbooks should present our nation's patriots in a way that would honor and respect them. In her eyes, admitting Keller's socialism and Wilson's racism would hardly do that. In the early 1920s, the American Legion said that authors of textbooks are at fault in placing before immature pupils the blunders, foibles, and frailties of prominent heroes and patriots of our nation. The Legion would hardly be able to fault today's history textbooks on this count. Perhaps we can go further. I began with Helen Keller because omitting the last 64 years of her life exemplifies the sort of culture-serving distortion that will be discussed later in this book. We teach Keller as an ideal, not a real person, to inspire our young people to emulate her. Keller becomes a mythic figure, the woman who overcame. But for what? There is no content. Just look what she accomplished, we're exhorted. Yet we haven't a clue as to what that really was. Keller didn't want to be frozen in childhood. She herself stressed that the meaning of her life lay in what she did once she overcame her disability. In 1929, when she was nearing 50, she wrote a second volume of autobiography, entitled Midstream, that described her social philosophy in some detail. Keller wrote about visiting mill towns, mining towns, and packing towns where workers were on strike. She intended that we learn of these experiences and of the conclusions to which they led her. Consistent with our American ideology of individualism, the truncated version of Helen Keller's story sanitizes a hero, leaving only the virtues of self-help and hard work. Keller herself, while scarcely opposing hard work, explicitly rejected this ideology. I had once believed that we were all masters of our fate, that we could mold our lives into any form we pleased. I had overcome deafness and blindness sufficiently to be happy, and I supposed that anyone could come out victorious if he threw himself valiantly into life's struggle. But as I went more and more about the country, I learned that I had spoken with assurance on a subject I knew little about. I forgot that I owed my success partly to the advantages of my birth and environment. Now, however, I learned that the power to rise in the world is not within the reach of everyone. Textbooks don't want to touch this idea. There are three great taboos in textbook publishing, an editor at one of the biggest houses told me: sex, religion, and social class. While I had been able to guess the first two, the third floored me. Sociologists know the importance of social class, after all. Reviewing American history textbooks convinced me that this editor was right, however. The notion that opportunity might be unequal in America, that not everyone has the power to rise in the world, is anathema to textbook authors, and to many teachers as well. Educators would much rather present Keller as a bland source of encouragement and inspiration to our young. If she can do it, you can do it. So they leave out her adult life and make her entire existence over into a vague up-by-the-bootstraps operation. In the process, they make this passionate fighter for the poor into something she never was in life. Boring. Woodrow Wilson gets similarly whitewashed. Although some history textbooks disclose more than others about the seamy underside of Wilson's presidency, all 12 books reviewed share a common tone: respectful, patriotic, even adulatory. Ironically, Wilson was widely despised in the 1920s, and it was only after World War II that he came to be viewed kindly by policymakers and historians. Our post-war bipartisan foreign policy, one of far-reaching interventions sheathed in humanitarian explanations, was shaped decisively by the ideology and the international program developed by the Wilson administration, according to N. Gordon Levin, Jr. Textbook authors are thus motivated to underplay or excuse Wilson's foreign interventions, many of which were counterproductive blunders, as well as other unsatisfactory aspects of his administration. A host of other reasons: pressure from the ruling class, pressure from textbook adoption committees, the wish to avoid ambiguities, a desire to shield children from harm or conflict, the perceived need to control children and avoid classroom disharmony, pressure to provide answers, may help explain why textbooks omit troublesome facts. A certain etiquette coerces us all into speaking in respectful tones about the past, especially when we're passing on our heritage to our young. Could it be that we don't want to think badly of Woodrow Wilson? We seem to feel that a person like Helen Keller can be an inspiration only so long as she remains uncontroversial, one-dimensional. We don't want complicated icons. People do not like to think. If one thinks, one must reach conclusions, Helen Keller pointed out. Conclusions are not always pleasant. Most of us automatically shy away from conflict, and understandably so. We particularly seek to avoid conflict in the classroom. One reason is habit. We are so accustomed to blandness that the textbook or teacher who brought real intellectual controversy into the classroom would strike us as a violation of polite rhetoric, of classroom norms. We are supposed to speak well of the deceased, after all. Probably we are supposed to maintain the same attitude of awe, reverence, and respect when we read about our national heroes as when we visit our national cathedral and view the final resting places of Helen Keller and Woodrow Wilson, as close physically in death as they were distant ideologically in life. Whatever the causes, the results of heroification are potentially crippling to students. Helen Keller isn't the only person this approach treats like a child. Denying students the humanness of Keller, Wilson, and others keeps students in intellectual immaturity. It perpetuates what might be called a Disney version of history. The Hall of Presidents at Disneyland similarly presents our leaders as heroic statesmen, not imperfect human beings. Our children end up without realistic role models to inspire them. Students also develop no understanding of causality in history. Our nation's 13 separate forays into Nicaragua, for instance, are surely worth knowing about as we attempt to understand why that country embraced a communist government in the 1980s. Textbooks should show history as contingent, affected by the power of ideas and individuals. Instead, they present history as a done deal. Do textbooks, film strips, and American history courses achieve the results they seek with regard to our heroes? Surely textbook authors want us to think well of the historical figures they treat with such sympathy. And on a superficial level, at least, we do. Almost no recent high school graduates have anything bad to say about either Keller or Wilson. But are these two considered heroes? I have asked hundreds of mostly white college students on the first day of class to tell me who their heroes in American history are. As a rule, they don't pick Helen Keller, Woodrow Wilson, Christopher Columbus, Miles Standish, or anyone else in Plymouth, John Smith, or anyone else in Virginia, Abraham Lincoln, or indeed anyone else in American history whom the textbooks implore them to choose. Our post-Watergate students view all such establishment heroes cynically. They're boring. Some students choose none. That is, they say they have no heroes in American history. Other students display the characteristically American sympathy for the underdog by choosing African Americans, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, perhaps Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, or Frederick Douglass. Or they choose men and women from other countries, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, or, now fading fast, Mikhail Gorbachev or Boris Yeltsin. In one sense, this is a healthy development. Surely we want students to be skeptical. Probably we want them to challenge being told whom to believe in. But replying none is too glib, too nihilistic for my taste. It is, however, an understandable response to heroification. For when textbook authors leave out the warts, the problems, the unfortunate character traits, the mistaken ideas, They reduce heroes from dramatic men and women to melodramatic stick figures. Their inner struggles disappear, and they become goody-goody, not merely good. Students poke fun at the goody-goodiness of them all by passing on Helen Keller jokes. In doing so, school children are not poking cruel fun at a disabled person. They are deflating a pretentious symbol that is too good to be real. Nonetheless, our loss of Helen Keller as anything but a source of jokes is distressing. Knowing the reality of her quite amazing life might empower not only deaf or blind students, but any schoolgirl, and perhaps boys as well. For like other peoples around the world, we Americans need heroes. Statements such as, "If Martin Luther King were alive, he'd," suggest one function of historical figures in our contemporary society. Most of us tend to think well of ourselves when we have acted as we imagine our heroes might have done. Who our heroes are, and whether they are presented in a way that makes them lifelike, hence usable as role models, could have a significant bearing on our conduct in the world. We now turn to our first hero, Christopher Columbus. "Care should be taken to vindicate great names from pernicious erudition," wrote Washington Irving, defending heroification. Irving's three-volume biography of Columbus, published in 1828, still influences what high school teachers and textbooks say about the great navigator. Therefore, it will come as no surprise that heroification has stolen from us the important facets of his life, leaving only melodramatic minutiae. Chapter 2. 1493. The True Importance of Christopher Columbus. Columbus is above all the figure with whom the modern age, the age by which we may delineate these past 500 years, properly begins. And in his character, as in his exploits, we are given an extraordinary insight into the patterns that shaped the age at its start, and still for the most part shape it today. Kirkpatrick Sale. As a subject for research, the possibility of African discovery of America has never been a tempting one for American historians. In a sense, we choose our own history, or more accurately, we select those vistas of history for our examinations, which promise us the greatest satisfaction, and we have had little appetite to explore the possibility that our founding father was a black man. Samuel D. Marble. "History is the polemics of the victor," William F. Buckley, Jr. What we committed in the Indies stands out among the most unpardonable offenses ever committed against God and mankind, and this trade in Indian slaves, as one of the most unjust, evil, and cruel among them. Bartolomé de las Casas. In 1493, Columbus stole all he could see. Traditional verse, updated. In 1492, Christopher Columbus sailed in from the blue. American history books present Columbus pretty much without precedent, and they portray him as America's first great hero. In so canonizing him, they reflect our national culture. Indeed, now that President's Day has combined Washington's and Lincoln's birthday, Columbus is one of only two people the United States honors by name in a national holiday. The one date that every schoolchild remembers is 1492, and sure enough, all 12 textbooks I surveyed include it. But they leave out virtually everything that is important to know about Columbus and the European exploration of the Americas. Meanwhile, they make up all kinds of details to tell a better story and to humanize Columbus so that readers will identify with him. Columbus, like Christ, was so pivotal that historians use him to divide the past into epochs, making the Americas before 1492 pre-Columbian. American history textbooks recognize Columbus's importance by granting him an average of 800 words, 2.5 pages, including a picture and a map. A lot of space, considering all the material these books must cover. Their heroic collective account goes something like this. Born in Genoa, Italy, of humble parents, Christopher Columbus grew up to become an experienced seafarer. He sailed the Atlantic as far as Iceland and West Africa. His adventures convinced him that the world must be round. Therefore, the fabled riches of the East, spices, silk, and gold, could be had by sailing west, superseding the overland route through the Middle East, which the Turks had closed off to commerce. To get funding for his enterprise, Columbus beseeched monarch after monarch in Western Europe. After at first being dismissed by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, Columbus finally got his chance when Queen Isabella decided to underwrite a modest expedition. Columbus outfitted 3 pitifully small ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and set forth from Spain. The journey was difficult. The ships sailed west into the unknown Atlantic for more than 2 months. The crew almost mutinied and threatened to throw Columbus overboard. Finally, they reached the West Indies on October 12th, 1492. Although Columbus made 3 more voyages to America, he never really knew he had discovered a new world. He died in obscurity, unappreciated and penniless. Yet without his daring, American history would have been very different. For in a sense, Columbus made it all possible. Unfortunately, almost everything in this traditional account is either wrong or unverifiable. The authors of history textbooks have taken us on a trip of their own, away from the facts of history, into the realm of myth. They and we have been duped by an outrageous concoction of lies, half-truths, truths, and omissions that is in large part traceable to the first half of the 19th century. The textbook's first mistake is to underplay previous explorers. People from other continents had reached the Americas many times before 1492. Even if Columbus had never sailed, other Europeans would have soon reached the Americas. Indeed, Europeans may already have been fishing off Newfoundland in the 1480s. In a sense, Columbus's voyage wasn't the first, but the last discovery of the Americas. It was epoch-making because of the way in which Europe responded. Columbus's importance is therefore primarily attributable to changing conditions in Europe, not to his having reached a new continent. American history textbooks seem to understand the need to cover social changes in Europe in the years leading up to 1492. They point out that history passed the Vikings by and devote several pages to the reasons Europe was ready this time to take advantage of the discovery of America, as one textbook puts it. Unfortunately, none of the textbooks provides substantive analysis of the major changes that prompted the new response. All but one of the 12 books I examined begin the Columbus story with Marco Polo and the Crusades. American adventures start simply with Columbus. Here is their composite account of what was happening in Europe. Life in Europe was slow-paced. Curiosity about the rest of the world was at a low point. Then, many changes took place in Europe during the 500 years before Columbus's discovery of the Americas in 1492. People's horizons gradually widened, and they became more curious about the world beyond their own localities. Europe was stirring with new ideas. Many Europeans were filled with burning curiosity. They were living in a period called the Renaissance, what started Europeans thinking new thoughts and dreaming new dreams. A series of wars called the Crusades were partly responsible. The Crusades caused great changes in the ways that Europeans thought and acted. The desire for more trade quickly spread. The old trade routes to Asia had always been very difficult. The accounts resemble each other closely. Sometimes different textbooks even use the same phrases. Overall, the level of scholarship is discouragingly low, perhaps because their authors are more at home in American history than European history. They provide no real causal explanations for the age of European conquest. Instead, they argue for Europe's greatness in transparently psychological terms. People grew more curious. Such arguments make sociologists smile. We know that nobody measured the curiosity level in Spain in 1492, or can with authority compare it to the curiosity level in, say, Norway or Iceland in 1005. Here is the account in the American way. What made these Europeans so daring was their belief in themselves. The people of Europe believed that human beings were the highest form of life on earth. This was the philosophy, or belief, of humanism. It was combined with a growing interest in technology or tools and their uses. The Europeans believed that by using their intelligence, they could develop new ways to do things. This isn't the place to debate the precepts or significance of humanism, a philosophical movement that clashed with Orthodox Catholicism. In any case, humanism can hardly explain Columbus, since he and his royal sponsors were devout Orthodox Catholics, not humanists. The American way tells us, nonetheless, that Columbus had the humanists' belief that people could do anything if they knew enough and tried hard enough. This is Columbus as the little engine that could. Several textbooks claim that Europe was becoming richer, and that the new wealth led to more trade. Actually, as the historian Angus Calder has pointed out, Europe was smaller and poorer in the 15th century than it had been in the 13th, owing in part to the bubonic plague. Some teachers still teach what their predecessors taught me 40 years ago, that Europe needed spices to disguise the taste of bad meat. But the bad Turks cut off the spice trade. Three books, The American Tradition, Land of Promise, and The American Way, repeat this falsehood. In the words of Land of Promise, "Then, after 1453, when Constantinople fell to the Turks, trade with the East all but stopped. But A.H. Liebeyer disproved this statement in 1915. Turkey had nothing to do with the development of new routes to the Indies. On the contrary, the Turks had every reason to keep the old Eastern Mediterranean route open, since they made money from it." In 1957, Jacques Barzin and Henry Graff published a book that has become a standard treatise for graduate students of history, The Modern Researcher, in which they pointed out how since 1915 textbooks have perpetuated this particular error. Probably several of the half-dozen authors of the offending textbooks encountered The Modern Researcher in graduate school. Somehow the information didn't stick, though. This may be because blaming Turks fits with the West's archetypal conviction that followers of Islam are likely to behave irrationally or nastily. In proposing that Congress declare Columbus Day a national holiday in 1963, Representative Roland Libinati put it this way: "His Christian faith gave to him a religious incentive to thwart the piratical activities of the Turkish marauders preying upon the trading ships of the Christian world." The American Tradition, Land of Promise, and The American Way continue to reinforce this archetype of a vaguely threatening Islam. College students today are therefore astonished to learn that Turks and Moors allowed Jews and Christians freedom of worship at a time when European Christians tortured or expelled Jews and Muslims. Not a single textbook tells that the Portuguese fleet in 1507 blocked the Red Sea and Persian Gulf to stop trade along the old route because Portugal controlled the new route around Africa. Most textbooks note the increase of international trade and commerce, and some relate the rise of nation-states under monarchies. Otherwise, they do a poor job of describing the changes in Europe that led to the Age of Exploration. Some textbooks even invoke the Protestant Reformation, although it didn't begin until 25 years after 1492. What's going on here? We must pay attention to what the textbooks are telling us and what they are not telling us. The changes in Europe not only prompted Columbus's voyages and the probable contemporaneous trips to America by Portuguese, Basque, and Bristol fishermen, but they also paved the way for Europe's domination of the world for the next 500 years. Except for the invention of agriculture, this was probably the most consequential development in human history. Our history books ought to discuss seriously what happened and why, instead of supplying vague, nearly circular pronouncements such as this from the American tradition. Interest in practical matters and the world outside Europe led to advances in shipbuilding and navigation. Perhaps foremost among the significant factors the textbooks leave out are advances in military technology. Around 1400, European rulers began to commission ever bigger guns and learn to mount them on ships. Europe's incessant wars gave rise to this arms race, which also ushered in refinements in archery, drill, and siege warfare. China, the Ottoman Empire, and other nations in Asia and Africa now fell prey to European arms, and in 1493, the Americas began to succumb as well. We live with this arms race still. Since the demise of the Soviet Union, the nuclear arms race may have come to a temporary resting point, but the West's advantage in military technology over the rest of the world, jealously maintained from the 1400s on, remains very much contested. Western nations continue to try to keep non-Western nations disadvantaged in military technology, just as the 13 British colonies tried to outlaw the sale of guns to the Native Americans. The United States now tries to outlaw the sale of nuclear technology to Third World countries. Since money is to be made in the arms trade, however, and since all nations need military allies, the arms trade with non-Western nations persists. The Western advantage in military technology is still a burning issue. Nonetheless, not a single textbook mentions arms as a cause of European world domination. In the years before Columbus's voyages, Europe also expanded the use of new forms of social technology, bureaucracy, double-entry bookkeeping, and mechanical printing. Bureaucracy, which today has negative connotations, was actually a practical innovation that allowed rulers and merchants to manage far-flung enterprises efficiently. So did double-entry bookkeeping, based on the decimal system, which Europeans first picked up from Arab traders. The printing press and increased literacy allowed news of Columbus's findings to travel across Europe much farther and faster than news of the Vikings' expeditions. A third important development was ideological, or even theological. Amassing wealth and dominating other people came to be positively valued as the key means of winning esteem on earth and salvation hereafter. As Columbus put it, "Gold is most excellent, gold constitutes treasure, and he who has it does all he wants in the world, and can even lift souls up to paradise." In 1005, the Vikings intended only to settle Vineland, their name for New England, or, more likely, the maritime provinces of Canada. By 1493, Columbus planned to plunder Haiti. The sources are perfectly clear about Columbus's motivation. In 1495, for instance, Michelet de Cuneo wrote about accompanying Columbus on his 1494 expedition into the interior of Haiti. "After we had rested for several days in our settlement, it seemed to the Lord Admiral that it was time to put into execution his desire to search for gold, which was the main reason he had started on so great a voyage, full of so many dangers." Columbus was no greedier than the Spanish, or later the English and French, but textbooks downplay the pursuit of wealth as a motive for coming to the Americas when they describe Columbus and later explorers and colonists. Even the pilgrims left Europe partly to make money, but you would never know it from our textbooks. Their authors apparently believe that to have America explored and colonized for economic gain is somehow undignified. A fourth factor affecting Europe's readiness to embrace a new continent was the particular nature of European Christianity. Europeans believed in a transportable, proselytizing religion that rationalized conquest. Followers of Islam share this characteristic. Typically, after discovering an island and encountering a tribe of Indians new to them, the Spaniards would read aloud, in Spanish, what came to be called the requirement. Here is one version. I implore you to recognize the church as a lady, and in the name of the Pope, take the king as lord of this land and obey his mandates. If you do not do it, I tell you that with the help of God, I will enter powerfully against you all. I will make war everywhere and every way that I can. I will subject you to the yoke and obedience to the church and to his majesty. I will take your women and children and make them slaves. The deaths and injuries that you will receive from here on will be your own fault, and not that of his majesty, nor of the gentlemen that accompany me. Having thus satisfied their consciences by offering the Indians a chance to convert to Christianity, the Spaniards then felt free to do whatever they wanted with the people they had just discovered. A fifth development that caused Europe's reaction to Columbus's reports about Haiti to differ radically from reactions to earlier expeditions was Europe's recent success in taking over and exploiting various island societies. On Malta, Sardinia, the Canary Islands, and, later in Ireland, Europeans learned that conquest of this sort was a route to wealth. In addition, new and more deadly forms of smallpox and bubonic plague had arisen in Europe since the Vikings had sailed. Passed on to those the Europeans met, these diseases helped Europe conquer the Americas and, later, the islands of the Pacific. Except for one paragraph on disease in The American Pageant, not one of the 12 textbooks mention either of these factors as contributing to European world dominance. Why don't textbooks mention arms as a facilitator of exploration and domination? Why don't they treat any of the foregoing factors? If crude factors such as military power or religiously sanctioned greed are perceived as reflecting badly on us, who exactly is us? Who are the textbooks written for and by? Plainly, descendants of the Europeans. High school students don't usually think about the rise of Europe to world domination. It's rarely presented as a question. It seems natural, a given, not something that needs to be explained. Deep down, our culture encourages us to imagine that we are richer and more powerful because we're smarter. Of course, there are no studies showing Americans to be more intelligent than, say, Iraqis. Still, since textbooks don't identify or encourage us to think about the real causes, we're smarter festers as a possibility. Also left festering is the notion that it's natural for one group to dominate another. While history brims with examples of national domination, it also is full of counterexamples. The contact between Norse and Indians around AD 1000, for example, though mostly unfriendly, was not marked by domination. The triracial Native American societies that developed after 1492, from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, through Florida to Ecuador, also offer evidence that domination is not natural, but cultural. The way American history textbooks treat Columbus reinforces the tendency not to think about the process of domination. The traditional picture of Columbus landing on the American shore shows him dominating immediately, and this is based on fact. Columbus claimed everything he saw right off the boat. When textbooks celebrate this process, they imply that taking the land and dominating the Indians was inevitable, if not natural. This is unfortunate, because Columbus's voyages constitute a splendid teachable moment. As official missions of a nation-state, they exemplify the new Europe. Merchants and rulers collaborated to finance and authorize them. The second expedition was heavily armed. Columbus carefully documented the voyages, including directions, currents, shoals, and descriptions of the Indians as ripe for subjugation. Thanks to the printing press, detailed news of Haiti and later conquests spread swiftly. Columbus had personal experience of the Atlantic islands, recently taken over by Portugal and Spain, as well as with the slave trade in West Africa. Most important, his purpose from the beginning was not mere exploration or even trade, but conquest and exploitation, for which he used religion as a rationale. If textbooks included these facts, they might induce students to think intelligently about why the West dominates the world today. The textbooks concede that Columbus didn't start from scratch. Every textbook account of the European exploration of the Americas begins with Prince Henry the Navigator of Portugal, between 1415 and 1460. Henry is portrayed as discovering Madeira and the Azores and sending out ships to circumnavigate Africa for the first time. The textbook authors seem unaware that ancient Phoenicians and Egyptians sailed at least as far as Ireland and England, reached Madeira and the Azores, traded with the aboriginal inhabitants of the Canary Islands, and sailed all the way around Africa before 600 BC. Instead, the textbooks credit Bartolomeo Dias with being the first to round the Cape of Good Hope at the southern tip of Africa in 1488. Omitting the accomplishments of the Afro-Phoenicians is ironic, because it was Prince Henry's knowledge of their feats that inspired him to replicate them. But this information clashes with another social archetype. Our culture views modern technology as a European development. So the Afro-Phoenicians' feats don't conform to the textbook's overall storyline about how white Europeans taught the rest of the world how to do things. None of the textbooks credits the Muslims with preserving Greek wisdom, enhancing it with ideas from China, India, and Africa, and then passing on the resulting knowledge to Europe via Spain. Instead, they show Henry inventing navigation and imply that before Europe, there was nothing, at least nothing modern. In fact, Henry's work was based mostly on ideas that were known to the ancient Egyptians and Phoenicians and had been developed further in Arabia, North Africa, and China. Even the word the Portuguese applied to their new ships, caravel, derived from the Egyptian caravos. Cultures don't evolve in a vacuum. Diffusion of ideas is perhaps the most important cause of cultural development. Contact with other cultures often triggers a cultural flowering. Anthropologists call this phenomenon efflorescence. Children in elementary school learn that Persian and Mediterranean civilizations flowered in antiquity due to their location on trade routes. Here with Henry at the dawn of European world domination, textbooks have a golden opportunity to apply this same idea of cultural diffusion to Europe. They squander it. Not only did Henry have to develop new instruments, according to the American way, but people didn't know how to build seagoing ships either. Students are left without a clue as to how Aborigines ever reached Australia, Polynesians reached Madagascar, or Afro-Phoenicians reached the Canaries. By people, Way means, of course, Europeans, a textbook example of Eurocentrism. These books are expressions of what anthropologist Stephen Jett calls the doctrine of the discovery of America by Columbus. The list is long of expeditions that may have reached the Americas before Columbus. A map found in Turkey dated 1513 and said to be based on material from the Library of Alexander the Great includes coastline details of South America and Antarctica. Ancient Roman coins keep turning up all over the Americas, causing some archaeologists to conclude that Roman seafarers visited the Americas more than once. Native Americans also crossed the Atlantic. Anthropologists conjecture that Native Americans voyaged east millennia ago from Canada to Scandinavia or Scotland. Two Indians, shipwrecked in Holland around 60 BC, became major curiosities in Europe. The evidence for each of these journeys offers fascinating glimpses into the societies and cultures that existed on both sides of the Atlantic and in Asia before 1492. They also reveal controversies among those who study the distant past. If textbooks allowed for controversy, they could show students which claims rest on strong evidence, which on softer ground. As they challenged students to make their own decisions as to what probably happened, they would also be introducing students to the various methods and forms of evidence, oral history, written records, cultural similarities, linguistic changes, human blood types, pottery, archaeological dating, plant migrations, that researchers use to derive knowledge about the distant past. Unfortunately, textbooks seem locked into a rhetoric of certainty. James West Davidson and Mark H. Little, co-authors of the textbook The United States, A History of the Republic, have also written After the Fact, a book for college history majors in which they emphasize that history is not a set of facts, but a series of arguments, issues, and controversies. Davidson and Little's high school textbook, however, like its competitors, presents history as answers, not questions. New evidence that emerges as archaeologists and historians compare American cultures with cultures of Africa, Europe, and Asia may confirm or disprove these arrivals. Keeping up with such evidence is a lot of work. It's easier to just retell the old familiar Columbus story. 7 of the 12 textbooks I studied at least mention the expeditions of the Norse. These daring sailors reached America in a series of voyages across the North Atlantic, establishing communities on the Faroe Islands, Iceland, and Greenland. The Norse colony on Greenland lasted 500 years, 982, circa 1500, as long as the European settlement of the Americas until now. From Greenland, a series of expeditions, some planned, some accidental, reached various parts of North America, including Baffinland, Labrador, Newfoundland, and possibly New England. Textbooks that mention the Viking expeditions minimize them. Land of Promise writes, "They merely touched the shore briefly and sailed away." Perhaps the authors of Promise didn't know that around 1005. Thorfinn and Gudrid Karlsvenni led a party of 65 or 165 or 265 homesteaders, the old Norse sagas vary, with livestock and supplies to settle Vineland. They lasted 2 years. Gudrid gave birth to a son. Then conflict with Native Americans caused them to give up. This trip was no isolated incident. Norse were still exporting wood from Labrador to Greenland 350 years later. Some archaeologists and historians believe that the Norse got as far down the coast as North Carolina. The Norse discoveries remained known in Western Europe for centuries and were never forgotten in Scandinavia. Columbus surely learned of Greenland, and probably also of North America if he visited Iceland in 1477, as he claimed to have done. It may be fair to say that the Vikings' voyages had little lasting effect on the fate of the world. Should textbooks therefore leave them out? Is impact on the present the sole reason for including an event or fact? It cannot be, of course, or our history books would shrink to 20-page pamphlets. We include the Norse voyages not for their ostensible geopolitical significance, but because including them gives a more complete picture of the past. Moreover, if textbooks would only intelligently compare the Norse voyages to Columbus's second voyage, they would help students understand the changes that took place in Europe between 1000 and 1493. As we shall see, Columbus's second voyage was 10 times larger than the Norse attempts at settlement. The new European ability to mobilize was in part responsible for Columbus's voyages taking on their awesome significance. Although seafarers from Africa and Asia may also have made it to the Americas, they never make it into history textbooks. The best known are the voyages of the Afro-Phoenicians, probably launched from Morocco, but ultimately from Egypt, that are said to have reached the Atlantic coast of Mexico in about 750 BC. Organic material associated with colossal heads of basalt that stand along the eastern coast of Mexico has been dated to around 750 BC. The stone heads are realistic portraits of West Africans, according to the anthropologist Ivan van Sertima, who has done much to bring these images into popular consciousness. Around the same time, Indians elsewhere in Mexico created small ceramic and stone sculptures of what seemed to be Caucasoid and Negroid faces. As Alexander von Wüthenau, who collected many such terracotta statues, put it, "It is contradictory to elementary logic and to all artistic experience that an Indian could depict in a masterly way the head of a Negro or of a white person without missing a single racial characteristic unless he had seen such a person." Although some scholars have dismissed the Caucasoid images as stylized Indian heads and the Negroid faces as representing jaguars or human babies, the faces nonetheless stare back at us, steadfastly Caucasoid or Negroid, hard to explain away. Ivan van Sertima and others have adduced additional bits of evidence, including similarities in looms and other cultural elements, identical strains of cotton that probably required human intervention to cross the Atlantic, and information in Arab historical sources about extensive ocean navigation by Africans and Phoenicians in the 8th century BC. What is the importance today of these African and Phoenician predecessors of Columbus? Like the Vikings, they provide a fascinating story, one that can hold high school students on the edge of their seats. We might also realize another kind of importance by contemplating the particular meaning of Columbus Day. Italian Americans infer something positive about their national character from the exploits of their ethnic ancestors. The American sociologist George Homans once quipped, explaining why he had written on his own ancestors in East Anglia rather than on some larger group elsewhere, "They may be humans, but not Homans." Similarly, Scandinavians and Scandinavian Americans have always believed the Norse sagas about the Vikings, even when most historians did not, and finally confirmed them by conducting archaeological research in Newfoundland. If Columbus is especially relevant to Western Europeans and the Vikings to Scandinavians, what is the meaning to African Americans of the pre-Columbian voyagers from Africa? After visiting the von Wüthenau Museum in Mexico City, the Afro-Carib scholar Tiho Narva wrote, "With his unique collection surrounding me, I had an eerie feeling that veils obscuring the past had been torn asunder. Somehow, upon leaving the museum, I suddenly felt that I could walk taller for the rest of my days." Van Sertima's book is in its 16th printing, and he is lionized by black undergraduates across America. Rap music groups chant, "But we already have been there," in verses about Columbus. Obviously, African Americans want to see positive images of themselves in American history. So do we all. As with the Norse, including the Afro-Phoenicians, gives a more complete and complex picture of the past, showing that navigation and exploration didn't begin with Europe in the 1400s. Like the Norse, the Afro-Phoenicians illustrate human possibility, in this case, black possibility, or, more accurately, the prowess of a multiracial society. Unlike the Norse, the Africans and Phoenicians seem to have made a permanent impact on the Americas. The huge stone statues in Mexico imply as much. It took enormous effort to quarry these basalt blocks, each weighing 10 to 40 tons, move them from quarries 75 miles away, and sculpt them into heads 6 to 10 feet tall. Wherever they were from, the human models for these heads were important people. People to be worshipped or obeyed, or at least remembered. However, archaeologists haven't agreed that they were Afro-Phoenicians. So including the story opens a window through which students can view an ongoing controversy. Of the 12 textbooks I surveyed, only 2 even mention the possibility of African or Phoenician exploration. The American Adventure simply poses 2 questions. What similarities are there between great monuments of the Maya and those of ancient Egypt? And might wind-blown sailors from Asia, Europe, Africa, or the South Pacific have mingled with the earlier inhabitants of the New World? The textbook supplies no relevant information and even claims you should be able to deal with these questions without doing research. Nonsense. Most classrooms will simply ignore the questions. The United States, A History of the Republic, mentions pre-Columbian expeditions only to assure us that we need not concern ourselves with them. None of these Europeans, Africans, or Asians left lasting traces of their presence in the Americas, nor did they develop any lasting relationships with the first Americans. Unsatisfactory as these fragments are, they are the entire treatment of the issue in all 12 textbooks. American history textbooks promote the belief that most important developments in world history are traceable to Europe. To grant too much human potential to pre-Columbian Africans might jar European-American sensibilities. As Samuel Marble put it, "The possibility of African discovery of America has never been a tempting one for American historians." Teachers and curricula that present African history and African Americans in a positive light are often condemned for being Afrocentric. White historians insist that the case for the Afro-Phoenicians has not been proven. "We must not distort history to improve black children's self-image," they say. They are right that the case hasn't been proven. But textbooks should include the Afro-Phoenicians as a possibility, a controversy. Standard history textbooks and courses discriminate against students who have been educated by rap songs or by Von Sertima. Imagine an 11th grade classroom in American history in early fall. The text is Life and Liberty. Students are reading Chapter 2, Exploration and Colonization. What happens when an African American girl shoots up her hand to challenge the statement? Not until 1497 to 1499 did the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama sail around Africa. From rap songs, the girl has learned that Afro-Phoenicians beat da Gama by more than 2,000 years. Does the teacher take time to research the question and find that the student is right, the textbook wrong? More likely, he puts down the student's knowledge. "Rap songs aren't appropriate in a history class," or he humors the child. "Yes, but that was long ago and didn't lead to anything. Vasco da Gama's discovery is the important one." These responses allow the class to move forward to the next topic. They also contain some truth. The Afro-Phoenician circumnavigation didn't lead to any new trade routes or national alliances, because the Afro-Phoenicians were already trading with India through the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. Textbooks didn't name Vasco da Gama because something came from his discovery, however. They name him because he was white. 2 pages later, Life and Liberty tells us that Hernando de Soto discovered the Mississippi River. Of course, it had been discovered and named Mississippi by ancestors of the Indians, who were soon to chase De Soto down it. Textbooks portray De Soto in armor, not showing that by the time he reached the river, his men and women had lost almost all their clothing in a fire set by Indians in Alabama and were wearing replacements woven from reeds. De Soto's discovery had no larger significance and led to no trade or white settlement. His was merely the first white face to gaze upon the Mississippi. That's why 10 of the 12 American history textbooks include him. From Eric the Red to Perry at the North Pole to the first man on the moon, we celebrate most discoverers because they were first and because they were white.